Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you do math at the movies? Know what it means to jump the shark or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Find out by listening to Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts. It's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Stephen Thompson, filling in for Linda Holmes, who is taking a much-needed vacation. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, we discuss the new film Dear White People. Does the satire about race relations on an Ivy League campus live up to the hype? Then it's on to a discussion about the state of animation. We'll survey everything from Bob's Burgers on Fox to some of cable's darker corners. And then we close, as always, with what's making us happy. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table and meet the newly reconstituted Pop Culture Happy Hour crew, Glenn Weldon. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Kat Chow, how about you? What do you do for NPR?
I'm a social media producer and blogger for Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, how about you? What do you do for NPR?
I'm a correspondent and the lead blogger for Code Switch.
Excellent. All right, so Dear White People is a movie that's been kicking around in limited release and just opened wide recently. It's set on a fictional Ivy League college campus at Winchester University. It looks at the intertwined lives of a broad assortment of black students. There's an activist aspiring filmmaker who gives lectures through a show on her campus radio station. There's a woman who's looking to break into reality TV. There's a big man on campus type whose father is the dean. There's an outcast gay student who can't seem to fit in anywhere. Ultimately, it all comes to a head at an ill-conceived party thrown together by the campus humor paper, which is evil. the party is encouraging guests to show up dressed like they're in rap videos, complete with blackface. Now, Gene, you've written about this movie for the Code Switch blog, at least some.
Sort of, yeah.
I mean, you've at least suggested that you have thoughts on this movie.
I have thoughts on this movie, yes.
Let's hear some of your thoughts on this movie.
This movie has been sort of been hyped for the last year or so, since Sundance in 2013. And so, at first, I was sort of intrigued by it, and then as the trailer started coming out, I think there was this, like, collective sense of dread, because the jokes were really, really, like, kind of on the nose, and they were sort of, like, really obvious, like, white people touch my hair, which is, like, a thing you hear all the time. Right. And I was wondering maybe if we were just jaded, because race is something we write and talk about all the time.
Right.
But what was interesting, sort of, about the movie was, which I don't think works as a satire, is that it sort of isn't satirizing anything.
Right. Right?
Everyone's holding it up as sort of, like, a really sort of pointed critique of, I think, one of the cut lines on the poster itself is, like, the perfect racial satire for the Obama era, which is, like, a sentence that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
But the movie sort of just points to phenomena and doesn't really have anything much to say about them. So there are four characters, and two of them might be sort of redundant, but there are four characters, main characters, and they all sort of inhabit different pegs on the social ladder at this school. One of the things I thought was frustrating, I should say, is that they're all broad types that we've sort of seen before, right? Mm-hmm. The biracial kid who doesn't know which world in which he belongs.
The tragic mulatto.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. Right. Which is a really old trope.
Well, you have several characters that are trying to figure out which track they're on.
Right, which is sort of an interesting idea. Like, the identity is the thing that you're trying to navigate and negotiate.
And that's very common in any depiction of college life.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. This movie, I thought the characterizations were a little flat, and I thought the kind of points that were being made through their tribulations or their trials and trying to figure out who they are were sort of, like, tepid and trite.
I wanted to hear more from the characters Lionel and Coco.
Yep.
So
yeah.
Coco is, she's the one who Steven mentioned wanting to be a reality star. In the movie, she kind of pushes the plot along, and that she kind of serves as a foil, I suppose, to Sam, who's the main character. She's the biracial character that Gene mentioned before.
Who has the show on the campus radio station called Dear White People, and who is more of an activist.
Yeah, and so Coco is not at all an activist. So basically, Coco tries to take on a more confrontational role in the movie because she wants to be on reality TV. She wants to kind of cater her actual personality to fit on that screen better. And in doing that, there's something about her that made me more curious about her, because I feel like, I wonder what this movie would have looked like if it had been shaped more around her experiences.
Yeah, I agree with you that I really wanted to know more from Coco, and especially more from Lionel, the character who is black, gay, doesn't fit in. He's played by Tyler James Williams, that kid from Everybody Hates Chris. That kid has charisma. That kid has comic timing down. And the performance is so small and contained because the character is very small and contained. And basically every line out of his mouth is muttered.
Right.
And it has the effect of making you want to lean into the screen to get more of this kid because he's so good. This film started out as a series of tweets that became Indiegogo'd into a film that it was also a series of vignettes, the writer-director Justin Simien has said, and that is very apparent. I do think there's a lot of narrative pylon here. He's going for a kind of Robert Altman crossing lives interconnected thing, and that's the decision to base it around these four different characters and have them all connect.
And there are many additional peripheral characters.
Indeed. But there's just like layers of backstory here that felt unnecessary. That whole rivalry between the dean and the president didn't feel like it belonged in this film. I do think I liked it more than Gene and Kat. But I do recognize a pretty central flaw in it, which is that I was not in love with the character of Sam, the activist, as much as the filmmaker is in love with the character of Sam. Everything out of her mouth is wise and right, and we see characters reacting to her being wise and right. She's dropping these pearls of wisdom. People recognize that they're pearls of wisdom. She carries themselves with this very noble, long-suffering bearing. It felt like I was being pushed into empathizing with her when all she had to do. This film is at its best when the dialogue is crackling, when there's lots of cross-cutting back and forth.
Yeah.
It's got a really smart sense of humor, some really good dialogue. But whenever it slows down to kind of focus in and make us feel X character, Y character, it doesn't convey.
I found this movie incredibly muddled. And as such, there were, you know, certainly characters that I reacted to much more strongly than others. There were entire characterizations that could have just been lopped off. I mean, you mentioned the president of the university, who is straight out of a Rodney Dangerfield comedy in 1983, as far as, I mean, there were several points at which watching, and obviously you're watching a fictional film, and so to sit there saying, that would never happen, is a little bit of a fool's errand. But like, the president of an Ivy League university, in response to an invitation being sent out about a party like this, would have absolutely thrown the world's biggest fit.
Mm-hmm.
The way university administrators act in this film is not the way university administrators act in response to this sort of thing. You would have seen race symposiums on that campus for decades to come in response to this. I agree very, very strongly about the Lionel character. That actor, the entire time, is kind of just operating on another level entirely. And he's just through his eyes, it's just your way into that film. I loved that character and wanted so much more of that character. One thing that I find in movies where you're bringing in a lot of people from a lot of, you know, with a lot of different perspectives, is when you find one that relates closely to your own experiences, you really latch onto that one, in part to interrogate it and see, do the filmmakers know what they're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, having spent many years at The Onion, I reacted very strongly to all of the stuff about the campus humor publication, which they get so massively wrong that I sort of felt like, well, where else is this not hitting where it's supposed to? The fact that you have a campus humor publication that is supposed to be this pipeline into all the comedy writing jobs, and yet the head of the paper is played by a guy who's like acting in a 50s play, you know, who's like the heavy in a 50, you know, just like, I just watched Pee Wee's Big Adventure and like the kid who steals the bike for Francis.
Yes, yes.
It's like got like the greased back hair.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such a broad false portrayal of like where this kind of party comes from, that I just felt like there were just a bunch of elements of the way this plot is constructed that weren't constructed in a way that felt true to campus life, certainly the way I experienced it 20 years ago.
Yeah, actually, and this is so minor, but I think it's worth pointing out, one of the things that jumped out at me as I was watching this movie was, why are all the students of color so serious? And there was a scene where Lionel rushes back from the party and he's going to the Black Student Union. Basically, all of the people of color are there. They're not out partying, even though it's like...
It's Halloween.
It's Halloween, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think about college campuses on Halloween, and I think about, you know, probably the many students of color who are probably not, you know,
like hunkered down in the dorm, like,
well,
thinking deep thoughts.
Yeah, thinking deep thoughts about race.
Hunkered down in the dorm, waiting to get word that this party is currently going on.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real, they're probably drunk at their own party.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
Right, absolutely.
Tasha Robinson in The Dissolve talked about how this director, Justin Simien, places the camera, the pacing of the film, and she called it an elevated, mannered calm. I think that's spot on. It's exactly the way it felt. It didn't feel like this ratcheting up of tension, this do the right thing kind of, you know, the something's going to give, something's going
right.
to break.
Yeah.
So when this happens at the end of the film, it does feel a little weird.
Right.
Kat, many years ago, while you were still a gleam in your mother's eye, there was an episode of The Simpsons called The Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie Show. And in that episode, Homer plays Poochie on a cartoon, and he goes into the writer's room and he says, whenever Poochie's not on the screen, all the other characters should be asking, where's Poochie? And I had that same thought, except for me, the Poochie was Brandon Bell's torso. Every time he plays Troy, the sort of golden boy of this thing, the son of the dean, who is supposed to be the perfect kid. Every time that he wasn't shirtless on screen, I was like, this scene would be improved. I think this scene would be improved by a little shirtless.
They should just have, like, screen and screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we should say that this cast is ludicrously good-looking.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some facial symmetry for days in this cast, and it's striking.
So much golden ratio going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
There's a scene in this movie where the students from the Black Student Union go to the movies, and they interact with the hapless ticket taker, and they're angrily interrogating him about sort of like, where are all the movies like Dear White People?
Basically, basically,
yeah. It was so meta.
Yeah.
What did you make of that scene?
So,
they're saying what the filmmaker has said in interviews about how most of the movies about Black life are about Tyler Perry or suffering.
Sure. Yeah. I should say that when a bunch of us from Code Switch went to see this movie, and we saw a screening of it in which the director, Justin Simien, was present, and his description of that scene made me dislike it even more. He said that, you know, he was trying to, like, pay visual homage to Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and to do the right thing at the same time. That seems incredibly pretentious, right? But the scene where they're sort of yelling at the ticket guy, as if that makes any sense, right?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a certain impotence to a lot of campus protests.
Sure, absolutely, right. So one of the things I think is interesting about the reaction to the movie that I think is sort of important is that, so the audience that I saw with must have been like 90% Black, and they were really young. It was a Congressional Black Caucus weekend, so there were people here, and they, like, congressional aides, so they were, like, you know, early 20s. And I got the sense that one of the reasons they responded so positively to the movie broadly is because this was probably a representation of their experiences, like, approximated their experiences in a way that a lot of movies don't. And so even if it's sort of flawed in a lot of ways, I think it's still sort of like, this is closer than everything else, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Tyler Perry criticism is just, like, it's so facile. And I think there are interesting things to say about Tyler Perry, but I thought, like, there were a bunch of things in the movie that he sort of referenced in this, like, weird shorthand, like, you'll get this, in lieu of actual sort of, like, critique of those things. Tyler Perry sucks. That's not a really thoughtful thing to say.
Right.
No one sort of had anything more thoughtful to say about these things, you know? There was a scene in which Sam, she says, like, you know, Black people can't be racist because racism is the structural power, like, with combined with bigotry, right? It was the thing you hear all the time.
Right.
That scene sort of encapsulated why I didn't like the movie, because I couldn't tell if the movie was sort of making fun of her for thinking that way, because I think that's a sort of naive position, or if it was sort of, like, siding with her, right?
Right.
I mean, and that's sort of, like, I wish it would have been more pointed. Like, it's one of the things that a lot of people I talk to about race a lot always kind of critique that position exactly, and the movie sort of seemed to think that she was really smart for having that position, but it seems like the kind of thing that a 20-year-old would think, and also you would roll your eyes at. So it's not like I didn't know what to make of that scene, just sort of like, I didn't know what to make about much of this movie.
So Sam has this white boyfriend who we meet throughout the movie. You know, he's there. He's kind of her secret boyfriend because she doesn't really want people to know that she's dating this white guy. So toward the very end, they have this moment, and it's very, I suppose it shows a much more tender side of her. When I first watched that, my gut reaction was, why did that character need to bring out this other side of her?
Yeah.
Like, what does this say about this movie and its relation to whiteness? I mean, it's obviously, it's a movie titled Dear White People, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying before about audience. But it feels like so much of the characters and their development still center around that idea of whiteness. And that kind of, that sat weird with me. And I don't know if that's just me reading too much into it or what.
But there's another character who sort of teased for having a haircut that makes him look unorthodox, right? He looks different from everyone else. And at the end, his, like, one of the moments of, like, him sort of arriving is that he has the same haircut as everyone else. And I was sort of like, this is really the really bold thing this movie wanted to say. Like, the biracial girl ends up being like, hey, I'm kind of white, and that's awesome, and that's okay too. And the guy with the afro is like, I can get a Caesar and I'm straight. Like, it was really kind of weak to me.
Well, not straight.
Oh, yeah. It's not straight.
No, I had a little bit of ultimately the same reaction to this film, which is there are there were a lot of journeys of self-discovery overlaid on other journeys of self-discovery, and it wasn't necessarily clear where people were winding up and why. Mm-hmm. It really, like, I come back to the word muddled a lot. It felt very much like a first film,
yeah,
in that there are germs of really interesting ideas, but a bunch of stuff that fell a little flat for me. I'm sure that many people who have seen Dear White People have strong opinions about it, and we encourage everyone to share them with us through a variety of social media. You can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH. Please like us. Or you can go to the Monkey C blog at npr.org/MonkeyC. Now, our next topic, we'd been saving this up for a while, waiting for Linda Holmes to go on vacation so that Glenn and I could nerd out about animation on television. Mm-hmm. We were originally going to just talk about Bob's Burgers and fan out from there. So, Linda, if you are listening to this, maybe in your car, whatever, maybe just flip to something else. Because we're going to talk about nerd animation stuff for a little while. Glenn, why don't you kick us off with your thought? This topic was originally animation.
Yeah.
It's like, with an exclamation point at the end of it.
And then a bunch of flip books come out.
A celebration. This is a huge topic. We are in a golden age. We're always in a golden age of something. We're in a golden age of television animation now. There is a specific subset that I think Bob's Burgers belongs in, which is, it's one of those shows that sometimes doesn't know it's a cartoon. If you close your eyes, the humor of this show and several others comes from interpersonal dynamics, comes from family relationships, comes from jokes and dialogue, doesn't come from sight gags, doesn't come from the things that ostensibly animation's about. It shares that with King of the Hill, shares that with Boondocks, I would say, and to a lesser extent, Archer and The Simpsons. Archer certainly has big action set pieces, but mostly it's jokes. It's mostly it's a family workplace comedy.
It's banter.
And The Simpsons, even, every so often, especially for the Treehouses of Horror, it goes all out, but mostly it's just pretty dialogue-based.
Right.
That's what adult animation is. It's not necessarily heavy metal. It's it's basically watching these shows. Now, there's also lots and lots of shows which have kid protagonists that are sort of even more brightly colored that do take full advantage, fully embrace their status as animation. Adventure Time, Gravity Falls, Steven Universe, BoJack Horseman. These are things that really take, that really seize the fact that they're animation and really have a lot of play with it. But it's not just for kids anymore. Huh?
You like that? I hear the same is true of comic books.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, I remember when The Simpsons first started out, somebody involved in the show was talking about what they can do with the medium of animation. And they refer in this interview, and I don't remember where I read it, where for like a 10-second scene, they just drift to a fantasy sequence where, it's where Bart gets hit by a car.
Yeah.
And he, for a brief moment, he's drifting up to heaven, and then he's sent to hell, and then he wakes up. And they were saying, like, that's the kind of joke you could just never do with live action. And we could just, it costs just as much to send Bart to heaven and hell as it does to have him sit in his living room. And I do think that even for a lot of shows that don't do like crazy surrealist Adventure Time wackadoo stuff, that you have opportunities, you're not constrained by any sets.
Right.
You know, you have this ability to tell a very broad variety of stories.
Yeah. Well, think about Jay Ward, the old Jay Ward cartoons, Bullwinkle and Rocky. That was
George of the Jungle, Dudley Do-Right.
Especially for Bullwinkle and Rocky, though, that was vaudeville. That was banter. That was bad puns, plenty. The Flintstones was the Honeymooners.
Right.
But that was built in with visual gags. You know, we open up the garbage disposal, it's a woodpecker eating something, going, it's a living. That's the joke. Over and over again.
It never gets old.
Never gets old. The Jetsons, sort of the same, sort of Mad Men with, I don't know exactly what's going on there. But it's all these old comedy tropes and given life in animation, and we're still seeing some of that because now the prevailing sensibility of comedy isn't shticky bad puns vaudeville. It's much more mannered and restrained and sardonic and much more Bob's Burgers, quieter. And more caught between the characters.
Well, and except, speaking of shows starring H. John Benjamin, you have its counterpoint, Archer, and there's even been an Archer Bob's Burgers crossover
there has,
for that
of
reason.
Course there has.
And Archer is nothing but yelling.
Yeah, that's true.
How about you, Gene?
So I think that this sort of trajectory is interesting because it dovetails with the like death of the Saturday morning cartoon.
Right. Which we talked about recently on the show, at least in passing.
Yeah, it was like, I think 3 weeks ago, was like the last final block of the Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, the end of traditional network Saturday morning cartoons.
Mm-hmm. And now
which
you
is
have
so
like,
weird. What are are people going to watch?
I know. It's so strange.
People love infomercials. God.
In the 90s, when NBC moved to TNBC, and when they started showing Saved by the Bell and California Dreams, I thought it was like sacrilege. Like, this Saturday morning.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Like, it's sacred. Sell me cereal. Sell me toys. You know? Uh-huh. Like, you know, and now that's not anywhere. And it's one of those, like, oh, I feel like an old person. But then what you see is, like, there are cartoons everywhere on all the time, and you can get them on demand. But, like, the cartoons that are out there, I mean, besides, like, the Adventure Times of the world, you have, like, The Legend of Korra, which is a show that just could not have existed. Wow. Yeah. 15 years ago. I mean, this big character development over several seasons, this serial drama comedy.
And it's gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
It's so smart.
I'm going to gush
over it. Tell me about this show for a second.
So it's sort of a sequel to Avatar The Last Airbender.
Right. Which people love.
Yes. It was the series finale of that show is like the most emotionally satisfying.
It's absolutely true.
Show I've ever, like episode of television I've ever seen. But The Legend of Korra set 70 or 100 years in the future or so. The protagonist is the next Avatar. She's a woman. She's a teenager. It's sort of dealing with some slightly heavier themes. Not that Avatar was the lightest show. Anyway.
And also what you were saying about how they portray women, it's just so different than many other
Right. It's cartoons. Sort of like very early on, they sort of go away from the like, oh, here's our love interest. Like, nope. She's sort of like just a really interesting on her own character. Her best relationship is with another woman. It's just really smart. And the themes are much more like the things she's fighting are not like bad guys necessarily. It's like these kind of abstract ideas, like, and sort of ideologies. But it's just a really like smart and clever show. And it's also like one of the sort of, I think, another way you can sort of see the evidence of how good or how much quality is in animation now is sort of the quality of the voice actors. It was like Henry Rollins and J.K. Simmons and Kiernan Shipka from Mad Men. I mean, there's just a crazy, crazy cast on the show.
Right.
Whenever I watch an old cartoon just from the 90s or the 80s, like, you know, G.I. Joe or Mask or something like that, and you always hear how bad the voice acting is, and you hear how much better it is now. I mean, just like sort of these people sound like almost plausible people, even though they're like in a fantasy world where like everyone can control the elements. It feels like real characters as opposed to people reading lines.
Like what Glenn was saying.
Every episode of Legend of Korra ends, and I'm like, why isn't everybody talking about this show? I mean, they are on Tumblr. On my Tumblr, everybody's talking about this show. But it's so smart. It's so good. And I'm thinking back to Mask and G.I. Joe and He-Man, the cartoons that I used to watch.
I love
and my
shows,
dad would walk by going, they're just selling you cereal and action figures. And I'd be like, Dad doesn't get it. And Dad so got it. Oh, my God. I have recently had cause to go back and see some old He-Mans. And they're just so terrible.
It's terrible.
And the voice acting is terrible. The animation is bare bones.
There's the animation. Animation.
Absolutely, you can just they walk and they
you can actually
the
see them
tree.
Slide the film cell.
So
and that's Filmation. That's the studio that did it. That was responsible. If your beloved show from childhood sucked, it's probably Filmation.
I grew up watching Rugrats. Actually, I did not like Rugrats. There was something weird about talking babies that really put me off. Hey Arnold, Recess, a bunch of other shows. A lot of them on PBS, like Sagwa the Talking Cat.
Oh my God, Sagwa! I used to razz my kids about Sagwa all the time.
Sagwa
I used
so
to
much.
Sing that awful Sagwa theme song to my kids to irritate them.
I would have like punched a chair if I had been around. Yeah, Sagwa. Not a good show for me, at least.
There was a golden age in the late 90s, early aughts. Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends, Dexter's Laboratory, Powerpuff Girls, SpongeBob, Samurai Jack, Fairly Odd Parents. That's when writing happened.
Phineas and Ferb.
That's when they got comedy writers actually come and actually start writing this stuff and treating it seriously, treating the comedy seriously. It shows so much. And also the level of animation just went way
what
up.
Caused that?
The computer animation helped a lot.
Sure.
So you didn't have these horrible stick figure drawings walking against the same background.
Well, they're just paintings sliding on
It's the worst.
Well, we've talked about the amount of cost that goes into animation, and you really have an unbelievable range of possible cost that goes into animation. You have, on one end, you have South Park, which costs like $15 and the same two dudes to make, where they can operate on the fly, they can respond very, very quickly, sometimes probably more quickly than is advisable to current events, and they're able to whip one of those things together in a matter of days. And then on completely the other end of the spectrum, you talk about animated films, where a 90-minute animated film costs $150 million to make because the rendering of hair on a monster's hide will cost more than the entire episode run of South Park put together. You know, when we talk about animation as a medium, it's about as broad an expanse of possibilities as you can find. It's almost broader than live action.
Yeah. And when it's done right, it can redefine a character. Okay, so Batman the Animated Series. I spent some time on this in my book. Because in terms of shaping the public consciousness of that figure, that show had a tremendous impact on a generation of kids, because before that, stuff about Batman wasn't really for kids. Like, comics weren't really for kids, the young kids. The Batman comics were kind of scary and really grimly violent. And that show came along and distilled everything, the history of that character, into fluid motion in two dimensions. That's important. There's a moment in the introduction of every Batman the Animated Series where we see Batman narrow his eyes right before he launches at somebody. We've never seen that before because it can only exist in animation. Sure, right. It can only exist in that pure way in animation. And similarly, Batman the Brave and the Bold, a more recent series, is everything I love about this character, everything I love about comedy, everything I love about comics in big, bright, goofy colors. And it's just fantastic.
Now, I have a quick question. We talk about the state of TV animation. Looking just at network TV animation, why is it all on Fox?
Yeah.
How come other networks are not pulling off animation? Or when they do, it just doesn't work. So you've got the Fox Sunday night lineup of The Simpsons. You've got Family Guy, which we haven't even mentioned yet. You've got American Dad, which is also a Seth MacFarlane show. Why are there not other networks making this work?
Is that like a function of momentum? I'm thinking of like, I remember when The Simpsons first blew up, in that time period, there was like Capital Critters and Fish Police and all
these things. Family Dog.
Oh, okay. They were horrible.
Dinosaurs.
Shows, right?
Yeah,
Family Dog. I'm going to stick up for Family Dog.
Family Dog, when it was an original short on, was it Amazing Stories?
Yeah, I think so.
That is a wonderful, wonderful cartoon done by Brad Bird.
Yep.
But like, I wonder if it's just a function of like, The Simpsons is sort of just so long-lived that it just has like the momentum and like there is associated with Fox. I wonder if NBC tried to put on a sort of quirky animated comedy for people like, huh, what is that about?
I mean, I think that's what's happened.
Yeah. I think we're conditioned to think Sunday night Fox animation. If like there was an animated show on NBC at 8:30 on Thursday, it'd be like, it doesn't feel that. It feels unwholesome.
Absolutely right.
It's like the new Saturday morning.
All right. Well, I am positive that we have forgotten some massive swath of animation past and present. Feel free to jump in and correct us through the means of your choice. Now, that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Let's start with Kat Chow. Kat, what is making you happy this week?
So I have this thing where sometimes I get really, really obsessed with a project for a month or two. Sometimes it's not even a project. It's something like a French bulldog, and I'll research everything about French bulldogs. This is like a quirk that you guys are learning about me that Jean has been privy to for a long time now.
Yeah. You're an obsessive nerd. I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah, completely. So ever since I started watching Mind of a Chef, which I think I mentioned a while back ago, I've been very entertained by the idea of one day making a Momofuku cake. So if you Google Momofuku cake right now, you'll know that these are these really elaborate cakes that look really pretty. They look like they're cut out and there's stuff on the side. It's usually a layer or two of cake and then what looks like frosting, but it's not just any frosting. And so this past weekend.
That sounds ominous.
I was going to say.
I mean, it is ominous. So when I was watching Mind of a Chef a while back, I just saw the whole process and I said to myself, one day, Kat Chow, you are going to make this cake. And so this past weekend was my birthday weekend.
Oh, happy birthday, Kat Chow.
Thank you. I decided to make this cake, and my roommates, I basically got them to make it for me. And so the cake that we ended up making was a pretzel cake. So it has a pretzel batter, a burnt honey frosting, a pretzel crunch, and an espresso ganache, and it was amazing.
Uh-huh. It was good as hell.
It was good. Yeah, Jean had some.
Yeah. Where does Jean rate? What?
Yeah, right? I mean, it was weird.
I was like, I'm just here for the cake.
You know who is your friend and has an appetite? Me.
And then another thing that's making me happy really quickly is growing up, I also have mentioned this before, I used to be a horse girl. And I'm going to whisper that because it's kind of embarrassing. But I recently discovered underneath my bed at my home in Connecticut, because Connecticut is the only place where you can grow up if you ride horses.
Basically. Sure.
It just has to be that way. But I found under my bed this collection of horse t-shirts. that I think I'm going to have to start wearing again and bringing back. So I've been slowly giving them to friends. And so if you're a friend and you've received one from me, it means that I really care about your friendship and that you also have to wear that shirt every time you see me.
And that you are roughly Cat Chow size.
I was going to say.
I don't feel as snubbed by this one.
that you're 12-year-old Cat Chow sized. Right. Think about that. But it was funny because I was trying to Google around for more horse shirts to actually buy for friends as jokes. And if you Google horse shirts, the third image that comes up is one of my horse shirts.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It's a purple one, and the shirt itself is purple, and it has a gray horse. Sorry.
You've always been on trend.
Yeah, I know. Right. I was liking stuff before. It was cool. Anyway, that was a really weird what is making me happy.
Cakes and horse shirts. God bless you, Kat.
That is the most NPR-ish.
I know. I regret saying that now already. I'm parodying everything.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
First, a mea culpa. Last week, we talked about Purple Rain, the song. People, I'm aware that there is no sax solo in Purple Rain. I was using Purple Rain as a stand-in for an era, a sound, a kind of music. So I didn't mean to disparage the Purple Paisley God himself, but he is sax adjacent. You have to give me that.
Sax adjacent.
And the song I was actually thinking of was Miss Sheila E.'s The Glamorous Life. I maintain, is a good song. If we could remaster that puppy and take out the saxophone,
wow,
great song.
Mm. Oh, yeah. What is that song with the sax, though? That's such a big part of
it. It's a big part of it.
Yeah,
better.
It's going to be tough to take
that's,
out.
That's my This I Believe. That's what I like. A whole raft of Marvel movies were introduced. We might talk more about that, but a Doctor Strange movie, a Black Panther movie, a Captain Marvel movie starring Carol Danvers. That's awesome. An Inhumans movie, which is a wild card and requires some unpacking. But the one thing I wanted people to take away from our animation segment is this one show called Gravity Falls, and it's on Disney XD. If you do nothing else, check out Gravity Falls. It stars Jason Ritter, Kristen Schaal, Linda Cardellini as two kids who go and stay in a summer with their great uncle who owns a tourist trap in Oregon in a town that has a reputation for paranormal happenings, created by Alex Hirsch, who does a hell of a lot of the voices. It's very funny. It's very creepy. And you get to know these characters like within a minute. It's amazing how much you get to know and care about these characters immediately. There's a central mystery that's slowly unfolding over the course of its two seasons. It is funny and witty and sharp. It's great. Gravity Falls.
Co-signed. Excellent. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby.
So when you're listening to a podcast that is not Pop Culture Happy Hour.
How dare you?
I know, right?
Never.
How dare you?
You should make some time in your podcasting schedule on Stitcher or iTunes, or however you do this, to check out Serial, which is, I don't know if any of you have been paying attention to this. Sarah Koenig from This American Life has decided to tell a long story over 10 or 13 episodes or about one case of a man who may or may not have killed his high school girlfriend.
Wow.
20-something years ago. And everything about the story is really murky. Like, everyone's sort of recollections of the day in which this happened are really sort of questionable. And so, like, every week she sort of rolls out a different part of it. And there are already sort of, like, blogs popping up specifically about Serial, and there are, like, other podcasts about the Serial podcast.
We should do a podcast about those podcasts.
We should. That would be super meta. It's from the American Life people, so it's, like, really it's great storytelling. You should holler that if you get a chance.
Yep, co-sign.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Serial podcast.
Yep.
So, big event in music this week, the release of Taylor Swift's album 1989. And I've already received several tweets from people asking, what do you think of Taylor Swift's 1989? And my answer is, I have not yet started to listen to Taylor Swift's 1989 because I have been so focused on Aphex Swift. A mashup created by David Reese, who did Get Your War On.
Right.
He created a mashup of Taylor Swift, not the 1989 record, but other songs, and recordings by the electronic musician Aphex Twin, who I referenced recently when I was talking about editing music, and who makes this kind of deeply creepy, kind of under your skin electronic music. And as with so many of these mashups, like the Grey album, it's amazing how well it works. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating repurposing of both of those sounds that meets in the middle. It makes you, our pal Lars Gottrich at NPR Music wrote, it really makes you dream of an actual collaboration between the two artists. Awesome. It's on SoundCloud. We will post a link. I worry that at some point it will get taken down, but it is currently available available for download off of SoundCloud. Okay. And I've been I've just been swimming around in it for the last couple
of
days.
Do we think he did it in as a tie-in to his show Going Deep with David Rees? As like maybe how to start a viral phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, he is certainly, I'm sure, trying to call attention to his various projects. Uh-huh. This was, for me, an unexpected one.
Cool.
You know, the song titles are all, of course, mashups of Taylor Swift songs and Aphex Twin songs. So you have, like, she has a song about Tim McGraw, and Aphex Twin has a song called To Cure a Weakling Child, and it's To Cure a Weakling McGraw. Mm-hmm. The lead track is, you know, the one that I've spun sort of over and over again, is a version of the song Trouble. It's a mashup with the song Four, and so it's just Trouble with a Four in it. Actually, let's hear a little bit of that song. Once upon a time.
Right.
So there's some neat kind of smoothing of her voice going on, too, that where she's bleeding into these electronic compositions a little bit.
That's some imagery right there.
Well, not literally. I find it intoxicating. It is enhancing my enjoyment of Taylor Swift's music. And so that is what is making me happy this week.
Awesome.
And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at I Dislike Stephen. That's Stephen. You can follow Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon. That's Weldon. You can follow Kat Chow at Kat Chow, KatChow. You can follow Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our absent pal Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KatZiff. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For word games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you do math at the movies? Know what it means to jump the shark or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Find out by listening to Ask Me Another on iTunes under Podcasts.